evening, everyone. Is that fun? I have to apologise. I have a swelling down sore throat, so I may have to slip off fairly soon afterwards. But you see me stomping away. It's not a cold, but it's not a very heavy. Sorry. I'm just going to start with a rugby poem. I guess you all saw the match a couple of minutes ago. And rugby played a big part of my life, not least because it was one of the few ways I could interact with my father, my late father, whom I wasn't very intimate with. But rugby union was kind of one of the few ways we could actually meet. And we went to our first big game in 1987. It was Ireland versus England versus Ireland. And at this stage, my father was getting quite ill. And after the match, it reminded me of the first time we went to a soccer match together, a big one, in 1965. So I call this two big games. My first soccer match was like a waking dream. Floodlights as pure as moons arc lit the grass, the white lines and royal colours of the team. Tobacco smoke cloaked the roars and sucked in hush like sea mist. My father, in the aftermath, cursed the crowd, bracing to save me from the crush. Years later, at our first big rugby match, I was lost in impassioned ecstasy, until the final whistle when I watched his jittery legs heave up his wheezing frame. I followed close as he picked his way down the stairs and pretended not to shield him from the thickening wedge of bodies, and to hide the stone-faced feelings jostling inside. And I'll just do another one on the same theme. I used to go around and watch games with him as he became increasingly less mobile. And in 1989, we watched the British and Irish Lions playing in Australia. And it's a highlight, I suppose, of his week, and certainly my week, to shout at the television. First time I actually heard him use the C word. somehow, he failed to fell from my eyes. And I also, when Jeremy Guscott scored the winner for the Lions, I screamed so loud that my father's neighbour downstairs thought he'd died. He came rushing upstairs, knocked at the door, shouting, "Brian, Brian, are you alright?" And he had to explain it was just his son, just his family. So this is called Rugby Union. Magic inside the sunlit television. We sit apart. My father, flushed and shrunken, gulping air, both entranced by rugby union, the cancelling man-to-man polarities, the chaos turning to organic patterns, bodies converging on the ball like bees, braced deadlocks of the scrum, the popped release of tension, the ball flung along a line as ordered as a wheeling skein of geese. Gradually the years of absence tick away, and in the silence we are lost as one, gripped by the infectious current of the play. This body flows with my adrenaline. My lungs are shortened by his fevered breathing. Right. from death to dark age. I'll choose a few from my latest book. And kind of themed around the dark age, which refers to the dark age period of history and my sense of spiritual lack of enlightenment, amongst other things. This one's called What's Common Rain. I read it by request. I once lived in Devon, where it poured with rain almost every day, and then moved eventually to Roscommon, which made Devon look like the Nevada Devon. It's a wonderful place, Roscommon, if you don't know it. Lakes and mountains and rocks and rain. Roscommon rain. When the rain stopped, the rain began, and clattered beads of runny light against the pane, decreased and crept inside the ghosts of sheep, and seeped inside the warmth of prostrate cows, then pelted bogs to syrupy peat, made gravelly lanes glitter again, beneath the melting greys of cloud and cloud, pierced the puddles of a thousand stings, tumbled silver through the hedges and off the skinned shin bones of trees, swept soft again like a haze of locusts across the ridge, then shifted shape in sudden wind, drifting finer than chimney smoke, like a passing pang of some great loss, away from where more rain was coming in, from somewhere else beyond the world's rim, erasing gradually the misconception that the world had ever not been rain, and rain ceased before the end of time. I very rarely write love poems. Love is one of those things that's kind of so difficult to capture. I prefer to kind of let it go, but I did write one in the rush of blood to the head a long time ago, when I was first, I suppose, not exactly courting, but getting to know the woman with whom I now live, Anna Kilsen. And it's a slight preamble to this poem. We met at a tennis club in West London, and one of the members of the tennis club belonged to the RAF and invited us to his airbase for half-price drinks. Because he was in charge of the base that night. That was grand. One of the snags was that my friend's brother was coming from Dublin, his girlfriend. Martin, our RAF man, so that's why I'm bringing him on. The other problem was that there was an enormous IRA bomb that went off a few days before we were due to go there. And every time you turned on the radio, full of the latest reports on IRA, this and terrorists, that. It wasn't great to be Irish at the time, for my girlfriend to be. Anyway, we set off and we got to the base. My rusty Daihatsu Charade, which my boss described as a lawnmower with a parasol on top. And I assumed the base to be quite small, the old train here and there. Turned out to be the size of Heathrow, and turned out to be the headquarters of NATO. And I thought we'd just drive into the mess and have our half pint beer and piss off. course, when we got there, there was this great forecourt, barbed wire, spotlights on the car. The soldier came out and said, basically, we're going to fuck you. Translate. So we said, oh, well, we're with Martin. And he rang through to the mess, and he said, okay, but we'll have to have your name. And I thought, this isn't going to look good. The name, which is title at the point. O'Donovan, O'Donovan, O'Reilly, and me. At the time of terrorist alert, we clicked off headlights by the guard post, handed in our names and waited, then revved the car, lit up its eyes, and drove between facades of dormant barracks until the British air base rolled apart like an international airport extinguished by a power cut. The runway's black expanse of asphalt gathered speed from giant hangars towards the boundary of night. And seemed so desolate, windswept, as if it needed something out of space to come down from the clouds and spark and spray and landing out. In the mess, it was another world. We four aliens corralled ourselves among the glazy crewmen, wailing like the dumb for music blazing into engine roar. A giddy couple shuffled out of pirouettes in the shadows of the dance floor. While drowning in conversation and matching meanings to the fish-lipped words, I tried to keep my eyes from lighting up whenever I glanced your way. Outside again, the glared city clouds flew parallel above the sleeping runway. We taxied cautiously from the car park and forked right at the switch box. One forced turn would have brought us into the immenseness of the landing zone. In the shrinking hours of night, we welcomed home your lamplit streets and smug, hot, timbered terrace house. And while the others slunk upstairs, you led me out to show me your small garden, the patch where you would clear the weeds, would wait for grass to prick the surface. The tangerine cloud was gone. Winds had shot the grime from out of space. And sparkling like mica, constellations, as if rejoicing at an imminent arrival, had switched on every landing light and avenues of stars across the sky. We survived the evening, but we had a bad moment when a very drunk RAF officer tried to dance with my girlfriend-to-be, and it was a very tense evening on a number of levels. I'm just going to read, I think, three short poems, three comments from a sequence about saints, and then record it again in the evening. I have this sequence on saints, and reading. This one's called Fervey's Vision. St. Fervey, as you may know, ended up in East Anglia, and he had a vision of hell. And he kind of lived off that the rest of his life. So this is called Fervey's Vision. The Anglian fens flow tide-like from my door. The sky is yellowy-grey, builds up the snow, and oaks explode in tangled lightning forks. Watching the rain become harsh sleet, I see a midnight valley. Fiery glow, demons dragging a sinner from the heat, blistered puffy lips, dead fish eyes. I knew that wretch was me, with clasping kisses, fear of my flesh, my lust, envy, lies. My penance, to be a stupor mundi, rehearse my tale, reviving the abyss, parade my scars and sweat for all and sundry. Pilgrims who seek the planets in myself, inside my eyes, two trapdoors into hell. And this one, the last two about death and afterlife, which is my perennial concern. And the concern of the people who wrote the lives of the saints, they were very anxious about what happened after death. There was a kind of waiting period before what was known as the general resurrection. People wondered what happened when you got put into the ground. Did you sleep? Were you conscious? Did you go to a waiting room and then go to the last judgment? And this story, since Carthage and the monastic graveyard, kind of reflects it. This is based on the legendary story. That evening, the sun was slanting out the crosses. When time expanded, nerves of colours woke, deepening the green of leaves, the grass and mosses. And then I saw it move, I swear. The soil moved. The face emerged, moon white, rose slowly, spoke. We live here so alone, cut off from love. For Christ's sake, bless us, so that we may rise from this no man's land of separation. Lead us together into paradise. My heart knotted as I told him he must wait in darkness for the final resurrection. And still I see his face, sinking to the fate that haunts my sleep, the scratching dreams express, my daily boxing in of loneliness. And the last one is called Finfin of Janina. And one of another anxiety at the time was, how much body did you need to bury for it to be able to rise on the last day? Which, the ideal of keeping the body intact was very, very adhered to. And obviously, when you fought battles, bits of you were being hacked off. It was a big problem. Finfin of Janina. The soldiers brought their trophy heads to us. Great swinging bulbs, onion brooms, purple. The thin lips shrunk around the final rictus. We bathed and dabbed them dry as honored guests. Then dug out grave beds in the cemetery. And, like mothers, laid them lovingly to rest. Lord, can any life survive these nameless heads? At what point does our flesh succumb to death for good? What if we buried just their teeth instead? Can prayers conjure souls from clay clay? We need imagination, Lord, not faith, to see their bodies on the final day, grown whole again from spirit-watered seeds, breaking the earth as carelessly as weeds.